Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, a delicious festival is happening next weekend, and we'll hear all about it. Jay Fox will also speak with experts about new trends in the dairy aisle and teen healthcare knowledge. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
The Columbus Food Truck Festival returns for its 15th year, featuring more than 45 trucks, nationally acclaimed musicians, and also a special Kids Day. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective to share more is festival founder and director Chaz Kaplan. Welcome, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited. I love this festival. I go every year. For those that don't know, where is it? When is it?
This year, it's at the Franco County Fairgrounds. The address is 5024 Northwest Parkway is where the entrance is. It's August 14th from 4 p.m. till 10 p.m. and then August 15th from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m.
And where can people buy tickets?
You can buy tickets at ColumbusFoodTruckFest.com.
And what are we looking at in the wallet?
$5 right now, early bird pricing, very minimal expense till August 9th at 11:59 p.m. Then the week of the festival, we're raising prices to $10 per ticket per day. And then hopefully soon, within the next week, we'll be launching VIP packages, which includes air condition coverage, special gifts, swag, some private entertainment, etc.
Now, you've added something called Kids Day on Saturday, August 15th. What is that, and what's the Kids Zone and Kids Market?
Oh, super excited for this. So some of the most popular feedback that we receive every year from customers, attendees, from the food vendors is adding more kids activities. Keep the kids entertained. It gets a little warm in August, as we all know. So let's try to keep them there longer and enjoy and have fun. So first, we've added a partnership with the Columbus Crew. They're bringing their inflatables and games, opportunities to win crew swag. And then also we have the Kids Zone. All of this, so the Columbus Crew is at the festival throughout the entire festival. Then the Kids Zone specifically on Saturday from 11 a.m. till about 3:30, 4 p.m. We've brought in super games, doing the slides and puzzles and all sorts of activities like that. And then separately, the Kids Market, which is a great organization that's bringing 5 to 12-year-old children with their parents, of course, selling knickknacks, little things that they've made. It's a nonprofit that helps children learn the spirit of entrepreneurship. And, you know, like selling lemonade on the corner, these kids could be selling candles, some of their toys, pet rocks, if you're familiar with that era. And we're going to have 30 of those setups on Saturday, on top of course, our regular craft or retail.
When you started this back in 2011, did you expect that you would receive national acclaim? Because USA Today says you're one of the top 10 best city food festivals in the whole country.
Well, I would agree with them. fortunately, that's not our first positive mark. Back in like 2016 to 2019, people were comparing us to the Taste of Chicago event, which was quite flattering. When we started this in 2011, and at the time I had three other business partners, you know, I was friends with some of the food trucks locally. We, County Commissioner John O'Grady, Mayor Coleman at the time, just had opened the Columbus Commons, and they were looking for events. And I was constantly pitching them on music festivals, different things like that. And they invited me and said, hey, Columbus Commons is open. We'd love to see the food truck thing, similar to what was going on in California, D.C., and South Florida, happen at the Columbus Commons. So We went and gathered 20 of our closest food truck friends. We put them at the Commons. We really had no idea what we were doing. And 20,000 people showed up and all the food trucks ran out of food. That was immediate, the first time that we did the event. And right from there, we knew we had something. And it thankfully has carried all the way through. I think a big reason for that is because of the passion that I have, not only for throwing events, but for giving society as a whole a momentary period of time to allow people to forget about their daily stresses of life. That's the true passion that goes behind this festival. It's like, let's forget about everything in the outdoor world and come and enjoy the festival, come and enjoy the music, and just relax. That's the goal.
So when we talk about the actual food trucks, walk us through some examples of some of the most creative food trucks that will be on site.
Creative. Well, the first one off the top of my mind is my recent love, which is glaze 'em funnel cakes. So they take your traditional funnel cake and they've turned it into gourmet. They're more like 3-inch circumference, sort of more thick, dense funnel cakes that use strawberries, Nutella, more unique flavoring that you wouldn't see at your regular fair. We've got a lot of Asian cuisine this year, all sorts of new flavors and tastes. Smash Burgers is a huge hit right now, with Fat Kids Burgers, Grilled Cheese Gangster. Grateful Griddle was one of the new local favorites, Ohio State themed with the Grateful Dead. They all make incredible food.
Now, are you responsible for making sure that they pass inspection, or is that something that they do with the state?
Yeah, so as a festival owner, we set up the fire and health inspections for the event. They get inspected about an hour or so after they load in to get ready before we open. The interesting note that some people aren't aware of, and we try to spread that word, is food trucks are inspected during the summertime periods, especially at festivals. They're inspected at every single festival. So if you go all the way back to the beginning of May, where you have Taco Fest, then Arts Festival, Red, White, and Boom, et cetera, all the other big events in town, these food trucks are inspected all the way through. Where you have a restaurant, brick and mortar, may only be inspected once, maybe twice a year. So, yes, that is all insured and handled.
All right, while I'm stuffing my face, I'm tapping my toes, what's coming up musically this year?
So we're taking a step forward and adding some national entertainment, starting with DJ Logic with Robert Randolph and friends. Robert Randolph and Logic are close friends and have been traveling the world for the last 20 to 30 years, playing with musicians like Eric Clapton, local favorites, OAR, you name it. They've played with them. Robert Randolph just won his second Grammy. We're super excited about that. That group will be headlining Saturday, August 15th at 7:15. PM is when the show starts. We've got some of the best local music, a band called Dreamland, young group, up and coming, kind of the pop, if you will, 21 Pilots sound, on 8 p.m. headlining on Friday. We've got a few great acoustic artists. We've got Johnny Moderation is playing on Friday as well. George Berry from Doc Robinson is kicking things off on Saturday at 12 p.m. And we've got about six other incredible artists. Also, School of Rock is participating in the festival, which I love having them. They're a young organization. If you've ever seen the movie School of Rock, young kids learning music, playing great cover songs, and every year they blow me away.
When you close up shop at the end of the year, what is the typical economic impact for the city of Columbus?
So it's interesting. We'll talk about the fact of everything that we just discussed are all unique small business owners and nonprofits. So with 45 food vendors, just them, and then you take 30 or 40 craft or retail vendors, we're talking about 80 to 90 individual small business owners that we work with every year. And I don't know exactly the sales that they have, but our estimate is every year since we have begun, they're generating over $1 million of revenue at the festival alone for themselves. That's very impressive. And then, of course, you go into the hotels and the parking lots and all of the surrounding communities where people spend money before and after the festival. So I would like to say that it's pretty deep.
I would say so. All right, let's review one last time. The 14th and 15th of August, the times are?
The 14th, Friday, from 4 p.m. till 10 p.m. Saturday, August 15th, from 11 a.m. till 10 p.m.
And it's ColumbusFoodTruckFest.com?
Yes, you got it.
And if we want to get in on the early bird deal, we got to hoof it before the 9th of August, right?
Yeah, I think it's a great deal. $5 a ticket. Entry helps pay for the entire operation. So, and something else that we didn't mention was our nonprofit support. So over the last 14 years, now coming up on our 15th, I've donated over $115,000 in total to local nonprofits like Nationwide Children's and Ronald McDonald House Charities that help support us every year at the festival. That's extremely important. And everybody should remember that food and music heals the soul. That's our purpose.
Absolutely. We want to thank Chaz Kaplan from the Columbus Food Truck Festival. We are hungry and excited. And for Columbus Perspective,
thank you, Jay.
I'm Jay Fox. Thanks for listening.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, we have over 15 different grocery store brands to choose from. The dairy aisle at these local grocery stores is evolving, and folks in Central Ohio are now relearning what they already knew. Dairy is an important part of our diet. Brooke Parkhurst is an award-winning restaurateur and author of the best-selling book, The Flavor Matrix, and she joins us this morning on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
When I was growing up, there was a cartoon that had a cowboy in it that was always hankering for a hunk of cheese. Is cheese good for us, or does it cause digestive problems?
No, that cowboy eating cheese, that's the best thing ever. I miss that cartoon. I
See?
Love it. Yes, the dairy aisle. Yes, no, that's amazing. Cheese is so good for us. It is so packed with protein, nutrient dense. That's the perfect snack. Hey, according to me, it's also the perfect meal, quite frankly.
So we should bring the commercial back.
Absolutely. We need that cowboy eating cheese. I'm all for it.
Why is the dairy aisle getting a second look right now? And why did it go away from our minds in the first place?
Well, I've always loved the dairy aisle. Once again, I'm with you and the cowboy loving the cheese. But I think everyone else, people are finally realizing just how many exciting new foods and flavors are showing up on the dairy aisle. You know, we have our foundation, like the milk, eggs, butter, cheese, yogurt. But now you can find so many different things like high-protein snacks, globally inspired dips, coffee creamers, lemonade, ready-to-bake doughs. I think we're all looking for the convenience, nutrition, the value and the flexibility, and that is all on the dairy aisle.
Now, we have had new dietary guidelines with our change in presidential administration. How does dairy now fit into the new guidelines, and how does it fit into the focus on protein, which everybody's talking about protein right now?
Right. Protein is definitely the buzzword. And so the new updated dietary guidelines really emphasize that. It's about the protein and the nutrient density. So we're already aligned with that, right? Our yogurt, milk, cheese, eggs, they're naturally rich in protein. They don't need to be fortified. But we're focusing now on the protein-rich foods that offer that convenience, that versatility. You're on the way to the station. You throw a cottage cheese bowl. You throw a high protein dairy snack into the car, and you can enjoy that and, you know, have the energy to go throughout your entire show. So it's exciting that dairy can offer that to all of us throughout the day.
Are you looking in my mini fridge behind me?
So what's in there? Tell us. What's in your mini fridge?
So in my mini fridge, you will find those the individually wrapped things of mozzarella or cheddar cheese that you peel and eat. You'll find a variety of different high protein yogurts. Peach is my favorite flavor. I have sugar-free coffee creamer because I have to watch my sugar. And then occasionally you'll see, you know, hummus or every once in a while, some cottage cheese with fruit flavoring.
A little bit of fruit. I love how healthy your mini fridge is. And really, you're telling the folks everything that I want to tell them, too. You know, you have the staple products. You have the cheese sticks that we've had for quite a bit now. But also the new products and flavors. Some of the globally inspired dips. Some of the creamers now with amazing new flavors. We have the seasonal yogurts, right? It's just about peach season, at least down south it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the new takes on classics. I mean, I think back in our day, right, cottage cheese was always big. But now, thank goodness, it is making a comeback on TikTok, so my 17-year-old daughter will actually eat it with a little bit of fresh fruit on the side. So we're happy for this innovation, all these comebacks that are, you know, feeding ourselves and feeding our families so well.
Now, we also have another subject to broach, and that's finance. If you have been to the meat department lately, you have sticker shock. And it's not just beef.
This is true.
It's chicken, it's pork, it's everything that you can think of. Even, you know, even things like turkey are more expensive. So what makes dairy the smart value choice for families?
Absolutely. No, there is that sticker shock now when I go to the meat section of the grocery store, or we have a great butcher shop here in Florida. It's a lot, right? All these price increases. But it's also not just about the lowest price, right? I mean, I'm in the grocery store all the time as a mom, and I want the double whammy. I want the nutrition. I want the versatility. I want the nutrient density. And so with the dairy aisle, we kind of buy those bridge ingredients. They help us, the eggs and the cheese, make our scrambled eggs in the morning, right? Or it can go into our baked goods. It can be part of a salad. So it's bridging throughout the day, and it's really helping to balance my grocery budget, which I love. This time right now in our, this time that we're going through, right?
I got a feeling that if you and I were to go grocery shopping together, it would be a 3-hour marathon, because I get really excited about new stuff, and then I want to go and I want to read the labels and I want to find out what's going on. So what are you excited about that maybe some shoppers may have overlooked?
Yeah, well, you know, we're heading into summer now, right? And we're down here in Florida, so it's all about what I'm excited about and what's great for summer entertaining. So that's fresh, flexible, and once again, nutrient dense. I love the cottage cheese, like we talked about. I wish you could see me right now. I have beautiful grilled cheese bites, great for the kids, great for adults, with maybe an adult beverage in the afternoon or in the evening. And then also some of the refrigerated doughs. I can make cookies on the go, on the spot. So refrigerated dough for flatbread. That's super fun when having friends and family over. So it's
they even
really
have phyllo now. Did you notice that? You can get phyllo.
Yeah, I love phyllo dough.
Absolutely. Is that how do you pronounce it? Is it phyllo or phyllo?
I believe it's phyllo, but I love that you love it. So you can call it whatever you want to, as long as we both pick up and put it in our cart.
Well, I put cream cheese and sugar-free raspberry spread in it and bake it, and then everyone thinks I'm bougie.
No, you're just smart, right? Three ingredients. Nothing bougie about that. You're just a smart shopper and an at-home entertainer this summer.
All right. So I want the grilled cheese bites because you can make them with so many different flavors of cheese. But for quick summer meals or snacks, what are you picking up?
I'm picking up the kind of the full protein, the dense Greek yogurt. Love that. Love Chobani. Once again, you know, we love the cottage cheese, the flatbread. So flatbread, I could pick up some deli meats to go on top, right? At first, we're going to have the marinara sauce, even from the jar. That's great. Mozzarella, provolone, a little bit of pepperoni, turkey. That's awesome. And then these dips right here in front of me. I have a great French onion dip. That's delicious with, you know, veggie sticks, maybe some chips. It's all just, they make it so easy now. And once again, so helpful when you shop on the dairy aisle.
And it's also helpful, I think, that they have a lot of these dairy items and even meat items pre-cut so that you can make a charcuterie board and look like a genius when you have people over.
Yes, absolutely. It's great for, you know, school sandwiches or after school. You know, it's happy hour. You have the great pre-sliced meats and cheeses. Go grab a few almonds, right? Some olives. You're ready to go.
Yeah, you are. You're ready to open up for business. All right. Where can we go to find more of your recipes and ideas online? Love the flavor matrix, by the way. Great read. But what's the website?
Thank you. Yes, for all of my tips and tricks, you guys can go to easyhomemeals.com.
All right. We want to thank Brooke Parkhurst for being our guest on Columbus Perspective. It was, I would dare to say, a delicious interview. For Columbus Perspective,
thank you.
I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
The U.S. Census says there are over 110,000 teenagers here in Columbus. More than half are between the ages of 15 and 19 and getting ready for life outside the parental home. A new study suggests that 71% of teens say adult health care is confusing. Susan Chansky is a licensed clinical social worker advocating for this problem to be turned into an essential life skill. She joins us now on Columbus Perspective, and we wish you good morning.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me today.
It's our pleasure. Susan, why do so many teens find managing their own health care? This is a puzzling word. They call it confusing. What's confusing?
Honestly, I think most people find healthcare confusing. Navigating healthcare is confusing. And sometimes we shield teens from that by taking care of it for them in ways that we don't with some other life skills, that we might help them go out and get their driver's license and take to the roads, even though that might be challenging for parents. But we do less of that for them in the healthcare system, and we really need to do better.
It used to be that in the public schools, you would have some form of home economics class that you would have to take in high school. You would learn how to do basic cooking, laundry, things like that. Should this be part of that exercise?
That is an excellent question. And I do think the kids who access school health services more possibly do a little bit of that skill building. Let's say they meet with the school nurse regularly because they have diabetes, and that potentially is in on their part of their education and accommodations plan. It's a really great space where they can do it. But also at home, and also when they're in the medical setting itself, is where they can really practice lots of these skills. So everywhere where we can pull in your health is an important thing to work on is a great place to pull it in.
When you talk to the teens, what is the most common thing that they struggle with when they try to begin handling their own care? Is it insurance? Is it just making appointments? Is it prescriptions? What seems to be the trouble?
All of the above. I will say teens generally do not like to make phone calls. So they don't like to call and schedule things. But that's okay, because they're welcome to use the portal. Let's say I, as a parent, might not want to use the portal. I always call the same person, and they always help me out. However, teens can figure out their own way of doing the thing so long as it gets done. So if they're comfortable logging into the portal, sharing with their provider, here are the symptoms that I'm having, can I set up an appointment, that's terrific. So knowing their own health history, being able to summarize what it is, I think that a lot of times it's really navigating of some of the other pieces. You bring up insurance is a good one. Just understanding the ins and outs is complicated for most people. So getting the help they need, whether it's a case manager through the insurance or phoning a friend, right, calling their parents, asking them how to navigate, they can take a little time in working through those pieces. If they can take care of the day-to-day things, like I need to refill my script today because I'm going to be out of this in a week, really staying on top of those pieces are important.
When I turned 15, a lot of things changed for me with my parents. I got my first checking account. I got my first job. And I had to start doing things that typically my parents did for me prior. If we were to adapt that line of demarcation, 15, which is usually when someone enters high school, and actually make them do the process before they go to college, would that solve the problem?
It would definitely go a long way. I love your ideas. Nationally, sort of guidelines around healthcare transitions talk about starting around age 12, talking about the idea of eventually transferring your care to adult, and working on self-management throughout adolescence. I love your example, and I think there are others where people hit a hard stop and they know that's a thing. Like, people know that when you turn 18, not only can you vote, right, and you are legally an adult. What does that mean in the healthcare system? We could think about that a lot more, that you'll be able to be the one to consent to your procedures. You're going to be the one responsible for your medical information. So I think thinking of some of those milestones along the way are great, and tying them together is super. My colleague likes to say, if a kid can order a pizza, they can call in their own script, right? There's just put these tasks on the list, that, as you've mentioned.
Sometimes adults are intolerant of children. How can healthcare providers help these young people who are making the shift and not make it so difficult for them or make them feel awkward?
I think, you know, it's great when providers can pull the young people into the conversation, and from early on, right? Like, they can ask the patient directly, what's hurting you? How's it been going? And start that communication piece. Do not always speak to the parents and let them answer for them, but really build up the kid's autonomy. And that can happen in the exam room, right? If a provider keeps asking the kids the question, and if a parent encourages them to answer. But some member of the team might be reluctant, but we all have to sort of move forward with it.
So if you're talking to a teenager, and likely you would be texting and not actually talking, what would you say to the teenager who says, you know, I really don't know where to begin? How do I take ownership of my health?
I think we could point out that it's stressful for everyone, and you can always ask for help, but jump in the piece where you're most comfortable. If you're confident asking questions and speaking to your doctor, then do that in the next visit and take on one extra thing. Okay, but I'm going to make my follow-up appointment, when usually I defer that to my parent. Like, take on a little bit at a time as you go, and that will make it easier. And certainly you can ask for help, but be knowledgeable about that and be, prepared to sort of learn and take it on.
Whenever I ask someone that I'm interviewing to provide a website for more information, I sometimes ask with a caveat, are there different sites to go to if you're an adult versus a teenager? I think in this case, it's probably appropriate. So let's start. Where should the parents go?
So first, I would encourage everybody to talk to their team, right? Your provider who knows you well. If you have a particular condition, there might be a great website for diabetes care or your Crohn's disease or your asthma. So speak to your provider team and see sort of what's their sort of trusted source. I think that's always good. GotTransition.org is sort of the national clearinghouse of transition-related resources, and they actually specifically have sections for providers and for patients and for parents. Especially for parents of young people who might not eventually be independent, who might continue to need help, who might need to be under guardianship and really need a lot more support. There's also healthcareshift.com, that just sort of offers for these different stakeholder groups, here's what you might need to know. And it's helpful for each to know what the other is doing, right? I've had teens definitely say to me, can you help me get my mother to stop doing so much? So everybody needs to know what everybody's looking at as well.
And is there a site for teens, or should they just look for a TikTok?
No, don't. No, please.
Right.
HealthcareShift.com should have lots for the teens to really sort of take agency over themselves. And again, their practice is going to be really great in real time as well, when they have a visit coming up or something like that.
So the overarching message is, get your teens prepared for life before it's too late.
hopefully it's not too late. We're all still learning to navigate, but yes, we're going to continue stepping it up and really leaning into this because you want to stay healthy. And if you're someone with a chronic condition, there can be real vulnerabilities in this time period where there, you know, you don't want there to be a gap. But even for healthy teens, you're absolutely right. They need to learn how to fold the laundry, drive the car, take care of the banking, and yes, make an appointment.
Absolutely. We want to thank Susan Chansky for being with us. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
We're looking at the big political showdowns, and showdowns they are proving to be, with political ads blanketing the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Ohio is in the national spotlight with a crucial race in the battle over which party will hold the majority in the U.S. Senate. Plus, we have a key race for governor. And those big contests pit Democrat Dr. Amy Acton against Republican Vivek Ramaswamy for governor, and for Senate, former Senator Democrat Sherrod Brown against Republican incumbent John Husted. And these two races are also proving to be very expensive. The company Ad Impact tracks and analyzes advertising data. It's projecting Ohio will be the fourth most expensive state this election cycle, with nearly $750 million spent on political ads. That includes $377 million on the Senate race, $172 million on the race for governor, and $90 million on down-ballot races. Joining me now to discuss how the big races are shaping up are Democratic strategist Morgan Harper. Morgan, thanks for being here. And Republican strategist Terry Casey. Terry, welcome as always. First of all, let's start with that advertising money that's coming in. Any surprise to you that we're talking that many millions of dollars?
Not really. I mean, especially when we're looking at the Senate race, this is a huge deal about who's going to have power in Washington moving into 2027. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now, just generally politically, and the administration, the president, is not very popular, and the economy is not doing that well. And so I think given a lot of those factors, folks are going to do whatever they can, especially on the Republican side, to try to flood the zone and make sure that they're able to prop up these candidates that are tied to an unpopular agenda.
What do you think about all that spending,
well,
Terry?
No surprise, because 2 years ago, $500 million was spent in the Senate race. We won't hit quite that much, but there's a lot of dynamics going on, including, as I've warned people in the past, and it's more so in the next 3 months, have your remote handy and the mute button, because people get tired of it. Because when you're watching Jeopardy and there's 3, 4, or 5 political commercials in a row, all name calling everybody which way, I'm not sure that TV is as effective as it used to be, because it's kind of gotten old. And again, the public, whether it's internet ads or it's TV, are getting used to ignoring it.
And you mentioned the negativity of it too. You know, we do see ads that are kind of like the introduction ads or the issue ads, where they talk about, you know, John Husted supports veterans, we're seeing that one, or Amy Acton introducing herself, and Vivek Ramaswamy did the same thing back in March. So you have like the positive ads, but you just get bombarded with the negative.
But it's like a sewer system, and again, the public is pretty smart, because again, Ohio over the years, presidential races, 2 years ago, the Senate race, people learn how to ignore and discount the attacks back and forth.
Well, and I want to pick up on something else Terry said, just in terms of how much we're flooded with content. Yeah. A lot of these ads, particularly on the Democratic side, we're going to need a lot of younger people, and I'm defining younger as 50 and under, let's say, okay, to come out and vote for us if we're going to be successful here. And where are they getting content? YouTube. Especially looking at the types of platforms now, the people who are hosting podcasts, that are hosting a lot of shows on YouTube where these ads might appear, they are very loud with their opinions. So if you're coming out with an ad that's a little softer, that's a little more introductory, I'm not sure that we have a lot of time for that. I think if we don't have messages that are cutting through very, very clearly about what you're about to do to solve a problem, it might not be paid that much attention.
I actually was going to ask that question too about messaging. Do you think, and I'll ask you from both perspectives, I'll start with you, Terry, but you know, are Republicans, is the messaging working?
Well, I'm not sure either side has figured out the right messaging, because again, people will make promises like Dr. Amy on school funding, the Patterson plan that's going to cost probably billions of dollars, but doesn't say where the money comes from. The public wants affordability, including property taxes, but yet people make promises to spend more, but who's going to pay for it? Because somebody has to pay, because at the state level, you can't print money like the federal government will. And then the other point to back up what Morgan said is that more people get TV off of streaming rather than off the conventional broadcast. So it's changed, particularly with younger people.
And same for you, Morgan. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there has been a lot of room for growth of the messaging. I mean, something that, you know, we've talked about earlier, take, for example, like we didn't have competitive primaries. I think this is going to be really relevant this cycle, because we don't know for sure where their energy is at, but we do have polling. We have polling that shows people hate data centers. We have polling that shows that people are very stressed about healthcare costs. And it's not going to be enough, in my opinion, to just identify those issues with some light solutions, policy-sounding solutions. You've got to be willing to show you're breaking through and fighting.
If we were sitting here a year ago, would you have thought that data centers would have been the big political issue that they are right now?
Not yet, but we haven't heard, because the data centers are complicated, because there's a lot of union construction jobs involved. And also there's a bigger national defense issue. Do we want the data centers in China and Russia and our confidential information over there? So
it's there. I mean, it's like everywhere that people are talking.
It's everywhere, and it's a big money issue. And I'm, you know, I'm going to push back on Terry a little bit here, because yes, we want to make sure people have jobs, but people, the regular people out here, general public knows this is a big money, big tech play. These guys are making a lot of dollars off of this, and they are now potentially tanking the economy with how much it's getting weighted towards AI, which is what data centers are all about. The public knows that. People are already feeling the impacts of high utility costs. They now know that data centers make it worse. And that's where I think there's a real opportunity to be aggressive.
And if we really want to put people to sleep, we can talk about how the PJM system works in 13 states and allocates.
That's for another show, I think.
And
yeah,
why they haven't been visionary in planning for the future. But again,
wouldn't put it in an ad.
But that's a whole half hour show, maybe.
So let's get back to the candidates, too. When you're talking about former Senator Sherrod Brown and current Senator John Husted, or Vivek Ramaswamy versus Dr. Acton, are you seeing these two races kind of shaping up neck and neck? Are they going to be tight in November?
Well, they're both very different, because for governor, you've got two people running for governor who've never held previous elective office and haven't had to deal with 26 cabinet members balancing a budget, figuring out how all the things work, and not knowing, because a lot of the state's money comes from the federal government, how will the rules be changed in the next 2 years? So whether it's governor or senator, and then the Senate, the interesting contrast is Sherrod is the outsider technically, but he's 32 years in Congress and older, so who's the outsider, who's the challenger? Because clearly, agree with Morgan, the public is unhappy with everybody in public office, DNR.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super interesting how the races are distinct in certain ways. Like Terry said, you know, two outsiders, Amy Acton, Vivek Ramaswamy, neither of them have held public office, and they're going to be new to Ohioans.
Or elected public office anyway, right?
I should say. Yes, exactly. And they're introducing themselves. And then Sherrod and Husted, consummate insiders. I mean, Husted and Vivek are part of the same apparatus, getting back to our prior point in conversation, the big money. And so we're going to have to really tap into the grassroots energy that is working against that. And that's where, you know, it's a little bit of a TBD
but
situation.
But be careful on the more money argument, because Sherrod's on TV more and he's getting most of his money from California, New York, and out-of-state people. So there's big money on both sides. And Sherrod, again, 32 years in Congress, a lot of lobbying contributions from the PACs. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's an insider. Houston's an insider more at the state level than the federal level. So
but I think the kind of money here will matter. And like we're hearing more announcements from Elon Musk, for example, mm-hmm. that he's going to be getting involved
PAC
in these
money,
races and PAC money, the outside spending money. Arguably one of the most corrupt administrations in Washington right now that John Husted has not done anything to push back on significantly. And Vivek having been part of that and the Doge effort and Elon Musk, it's all tied together and the public is connecting these dots.
You know, as we look at the Iran conflict kind of continuing and, you know, beyond the July 4th time period where people had hoped that it would die down and the gas prices would come back down, gas prices are still up near $4 a gallon. How much of an impact are those kitchen table issues going to have, as well as the midterm effect coming in November?
And talking to one congressman this week, I think the magic point is $3.50 a gallon, because if it's $4 or more, then that's a bigger problem. If it gets down to $3.50, $3. So.
And are Republicans getting blamed for that?
Well, there's a lot of people mad at Republicans because they view they're in charge, but they also view the whole thing, everything in D.C. on both sides, because the Democrats have got an interesting family fight going on. of the socialist populist wing versus some of the Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi sure. establishment wing.
Well, last time I checked, nobody was blaming DSA for starting a war with Iran. So I think this is Donald Trump's war. The costs that are going up because of it, people know, very much supply connected to the supply chain issues. And this is an opportunity to really expose just how much the American people are hurting. Data coming out yesterday showing how much the economy is really relying on consumer spending that is being fueled by credit, financing, debt, and the only business growth that seems to be happening is because of AI. Again, the most profitable companies in the world right now.
And getting back to the midterm, too, effect, you know, typically you see the party in power lose seats in the House and Senate. Terry, today, what do you expect to happen in that
theory,
regard?
That would have happened in 2018 and Richard Cordray would have been governor, but Mike DeWine got elected when Trump was in his second year as president. But clearly, it's a difference in turnout. And the off years like gubernatorial is very different than presidential, who shows up. And both sides have turnout problems. But on the Democrat side, except in Ohio, 08 and 12, when Obama was on the ballot and energized younger urban minority voters, the Democrats haven't had that kind of excitement at their base. So both sides have got a turnout problem on the base.
I'll give you the final word on this, Morgan.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that to an extent where turnout is what is going to matter. Democrats, of course, we don't have a great track record in a lot of statewide elections lately. And that's where, you know, some of these interactions that are having with some of our core constituencies, black voters, young voters unhappy with some of the messaging around, or not just young, the gay community also not really liking some of the messaging. These are the types of things that could be meaningful when we are hopefully will be in a position of eking out a close victory.
Now, my math might not be exactly correct, but I believe Democrats have only won one of the last, is it 22 or 24 statewide races, and I believe that was Senator Brown. Thank
more
you both once again for coming
in. More shows
in.
And more guessing.
Yeah, come back in again, and we'll do this again in a few weeks. Thank you guys very much.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State, a new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS-FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.